Listening to 103.1 FM and 980 AM WPFP Park Falls. This is Trail Mix 103.1.
This week on Viewpoints.
My nine-year-old, you know, she's like very expressive child, and she was very expressive in her grief, sobbing on the floor, like very physically exhausted.
Whether you're 9 or 90, grief is a complicated emotion that we all feel at some point. Then,
for every meal a food bank like the food depository provides, SNAP provides the equivalent of 9 meals.
In part 2 of our series, we look at the solutions and safety nets that help put food on the table for millions of Americans. I'm Marty Peterson.
And I'm Gary Price. These stories in depth this week on your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.
Oh, could this vintage store be any cuter?
Right? And the best part? They accept Discover.
Accept Discover? In a little place like this? I don't think so, Jennifer.
Oh, yeah, huh? Discover's accepted where I like to shop. Come on, baby, get with the times.
Right, so we shouldn't get the parachute pants?
These are making a comeback. I think.
Discover is accepted at 99% of places that take credit cards nationwide. Based on the February 2025 Nielsen report.
At Charmin, we heard you shouldn't talk about going to the bathroom in public, so we decided to sing about it.
Light a candle, pour some wine. Grab a roll, the soft kind for a little me time. Charmin Ultra Soft Smooth Tear. Wavy edges for my rear. So let the softness caress your soul. Just relax, you're on a roll. Let her rip. Charmin Ultra Soft Smooth Tear.
Charmin Ultra Soft Smooth Tear has the same softness you love. Now with wavy edges that tear better than the leading one-ply brand. Enjoy the go with Charmin.
Grief isn't always loud. In children and teens, it can look like slipping grades or sudden bursts of anger or hyperactivity. Using national data from 2023, in the U.S., about 1 in 12 children will experience the death of a parent or sibling before they turn 18. In this situation, one of the big challenges that caregivers run into is finding the right kind of help that doesn't make the situation worse.
I think there's this appropriately self-focused attitude with children that is appropriate developmentally, but when it comes to grief, then it's their fault, and they'll find a way how that death was their fault, and they can really internalize that if it's not processed.
That's Natasha Daniels, a child therapist who specializes in treating grief, anxiety, and obsessive compulsive disorder. A CDC study published last year found that nearly half of children in America with a diagnosed mental or behavioral disorder didn't get the care they needed. Most often, this is because of long wait lists to be seen, high medical costs, or not having access to the right kind of provider nearby. As a therapist, Daniels is familiar with these barriers to care and also draws from her own personal experience navigating grief and seeking help for her children.
My husband was a healthy 42-year-old. He got injured at work and had to have Achilles tendon surgery, very minor outpatient, and he was just recovering at home a few days later and went to bed and never woke up and died of a blood clot, we found out later. So I, at the time, this was about 3 years ago at this point, and my kids were 9, 11, and 18. So to have that sudden death, death is hard no matter what, but I think the suddenness of not having the ability to process a loss or see it coming was even harder to handle. My nine-year-old, she's not nine now, she's 12, but you know, she's like very expressive. She is a very expressive child, and she was very expressive in her grief, you know, sobbing on the floor, like very physically exhaustive for my grief, you know, that she was very like outward. My son, very much aligned with his personality, was everything was fine. There's not a problem. He wasn't an issue. He was hyperactive, which he normally isn't. And so I was kind of like, what is going on with him? But I think he didn't know what to do with all this energy, all this like the sadness in the house.
On the other hand, her eldest daughter, who was about to turn 18, reacted much differently. Instead of slowing down, she threw herself into overdrive mode and stayed busy cooking meals, cleaning, and trying to hold herself together.
I had to really put her back in line and say, you're still a teenager, go out with your friends, you're going to college, like this is not your burden, let's process this, you've had a loss too, let's talk about this.
Daniels could see the weight that her daughter was carrying. Her training as a therapist gave her tools to step in, but most parents or guardians don't have that kind of background. For families who feel lost, she recommends starting with the basics. Reach out to local grief support groups. Look into therapists who work with children or teens. And keep your child's school in the loop.
I do feel like giving your kids an opportunity to say, like, these are all the tools and resources we have for you, and then honoring what resonates with them. And so I was very fortunate to find Billy's Place, which is a grief support group in Phoenix, Arizona, that deals with like immediate loss, like a parent or a sibling. And I said to my kids, just try it 3 times. And actually Billy's Place was like that too. They're like, just give it, you know, we ask that you try 3 times. And I appreciate that because I would do that in my therapy too. I'd say, hey, and I don't want to come to therapy, but give me, you know, 3 sessions. And if you still feel that way, I'll 100% honor that. And so 2 out of my 3 kids decided that the support groups weren't for them. And my youngest, she was there for like over a year.
And grief rarely follows a linear path. For some, the effects bubble up right away. For others, they might not appear until months or even years later. Age, personality, and developmental stage all factor into how this reactive emotion shows up.
With kids, they hit a different developmental stage, or they have like now their brain is firing at a different level and they have a new awareness, or they have a memory that at this stage of life, they can reflect differently on it, or something triggers them and they process that grief all over again. And so sometimes when they're little, they don't process grief until they're, you know, 5 years later when they can really like experience that loss.
For Daniels, her grief wasn't just emotional, but it showed up in her body through chest tightness, sleepless nights, bone deep exhaustion, and a constant brain fog. Even years later, this ache hasn't disappeared. Experts warn that when grief is left unacknowledged, the costs can be steep. The American Psychiatric Association reports that about 1 in 10 bereaved people develop prolonged grief disorder, a condition linked to higher risk of suicide, substance abuse, and physical illness. For children, those dangers are compounded. Unresolved grief can derail academic performance, development, and change how they view themselves and their future. It's also worth remembering that grief isn't always about death. Kids and teens can also mourn changes to their own life.
A lot of times we want to swoop in and fix it. You know, we want to make it better. And really the biggest gift we can give our kids is validation that it hurts and that there is a time for grieving, you know, grieving a friendship, grieving a new teacher and an old teacher leaving, or grieving the change that sometimes I think it's just our intuition to go in there and cheerlead and be like, but look at this other thing that's happening. It's going to be so great. And it is helpful to sit in the discomfort with your child and say, I'm sorry, I know this is hard and I know it is sad. And how can we honor this? Can we write a letter to the teacher? Or can we write a letter to your friend that left? Or is there an action that we can do that can be somewhat healing?
To learn more about this topic, links to additional resources and our guest, Natasha Daniels, head to viewpointsradio.org. This story was written by our executive producer, Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Gary Price.
Coming up, food insecurity isn't just about hunger. It's about the systems and resources that keep millions afloat when Viewpoints returns.
I'm still going for it, even with higher stroke risk from atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem. Over a 3-year study, Eliquis apixaban tablets reduced stroke risk better than warfarin, and over 97% of Eliquis patients did not experience a stroke. A first stroke occurred in 2.9% of warfarin patients versus 2.3% of Eliquis patients.
Don't stop prescription Eliquis without asking your doctor. Stroke risk may increase. Eliquis can cause serious and potentially fatal bleeding. Don't take if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or bleed longer. A spinal injection increases blood clot risk, which may cause paralysis. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding or bruising, or back pain, tingling, numbness, muscle weakness, or incontinence. Aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners increase bleeding risk. Tell your doctor about planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
With Progressive's Name Your Price tool, you get coverage options based on how much you want to pay for car insurance. And then you decide how to spend the rest of your money, because you're in charge. Today, you're going to pay down your credit card bill. But you decide when you'll pay it.
Before the due date, so those interest charges don't get you. But you decide if you pay it in full.
But you definitely should, because again, interest charges.
With Progressive's Name Your Price tool, we'll help you find coverage at a fair price. And then, you're in charge. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Not available in all states. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
That's the sound of James adding long-lasting Gain scent boosters to his laundry this morning. Several hours later, James sniffs the irresistible scent of Gain on his shirt. Ah, Gain. Several hours later, James has even caught the attention of his mother-in-law, and she never gives him attention.
Ooh, you smell amazing, James.
Oh, thanks, Mom. I love you, too.
I never said that.
Add Gain scent boosters to your laundry. Add joy to your day.
Last week, we heard from two sources about what it feels like to live with food insecurity and its effect on daily life. This week, we shift our focus to two organizations that are helping people put food on their table. As prices for everything remain high, the need has grown. A family of four with two parents and two children that have an income of about $32,000 a year fall below the poverty level. According to the latest U.S. Census, about 13% of households, or 17 million families nationwide, meet this criteria and get government assistance. This can mean food credits, discounted health insurance, housing subsidies, and other resources. But there's another, much larger group who earn just above the poverty level and are also chronically struggling to get by. United for ALICE, a national research initiative, defines this population as the working poor. They're employed and often holding down multiple jobs, but what they make doesn't stretch far enough to cover rent, healthcare, food, and other basic living costs. By ALICE's measure, 42% of U.S. households today fall into this class.
ALICE is someone that we all know, but perhaps not by name. And ALICE is an acronym: asset limited, income constrained, employed. So if we start just thinking about the workers that we know that we rely on a daily basis, childcare workers, home health aides, delivery drivers, bank tellers, security guards, folks that we need to keep our economy running smoothly, yet struggle to support their own families.
That's Stephanie Hoops, the national director of United for ALICE. Hoops gets into how the current system goes against working people who earn just above the federal poverty level.
They're still struggling, but they're not eligible for things like SNAP and TANF and some of the most common government programs. So as a result, they are limited to basically nonprofit programs that don't have income requirements. And probably the most common of those are food banks and food pantries.
To provide some context, she breaks down how the government calculated the federal poverty level and who gets these benefits when the system was created back in the 1960s.
At the time, there was a consensus that food should be a third of your budget. So they calculated what it costs to feed a family of four and multiplied it by three. And literally, that number has been ticked up by the Consumer Price Index ever since. And it's the same number across the country, so it doesn't reflect the variation, you know, the difference in cost of living from Manhattan to Mississippi, from Indiana to Texas. And so that's out of kilter, but also it hasn't adjusted to what you really need to live and work in the modern economy.
This often includes a working phone, car, and other items. These are all extra costs that weren't factored into the original calculation that was set 60 years ago. Often, these items take priority in order for people to keep working and living, so other essentials, like buying healthy, nutritious foods, get cut. On the ground, food pantries are seeing this shift in recent years as already tight budgets become even tighter.
We all know that the price of housing and groceries and just the general cost of living is elevated right now. And so having enough to put food on the table for your family is a challenge for a lot of households. So if asked to pinpoint a specific demographic that we serve, it's really impossible because so often it's anyone. A lot of people are surprised that sometimes it's their neighbors. It's somebody they don't necessarily anticipate being food insecure, but it is currently impacting 1 in 5 households in the Chicago metro area that experience food insecurity. And when we talk about households with children, that number goes down to 1 in 4.
That's Cameron Mattson, the communications manager at the Greater Chicago Food Depository. The organization supplies food for food banks, soup kitchens, shelters, and other programs across the Chicagoland area. They also have a team that helps people in need apply for resources they qualify for, like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP. And this need has grown. Last year, the Greater Chicago Food Depository and its partners served 2.4 million households. That's 64% more visitors than in 2021.
Of the 2.4 million households that we had in 2024, about 13% each month were households coming for the first time. And so, yeah, there's, again, I think it's just the challenges of finances that are bringing people in that haven't necessarily needed to use these resources in the past.
And behind the scenes, keeping shelves stocked to meet this demand is another challenge. In 2024, Mattson says the depository purchased almost 40% of the food it provided to its network. This was possible through supporter donations. The second largest funding source was from the government.
Another 28% of our food came from the federal government via the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And then the remaining 33% was donated by food distributors and manufacturers or rescued from food retailers. And so it's really this kind of three-pronged source of food that we have that provides what we need to get to our neighbors and feed this vast network.
While the Greater Chicago Food Depository serves millions each year, it's one part of a larger resource network. Mattson says food banks can't replace the support the government provides through food assistance programs like SNAP. If this federal funding is cut, much of the burden will fall back on individual states.
Historically, SNAP benefits were 100% federally funded, and Illinois, for example, could be required to pay up to $800 million annually to keep SNAP available for our neighbors. And so, obviously, most states are not equipped to bridge this gap. And as much as food banks like ours want to help, we just don't have the scale for this. Because for every meal a food bank, like the Food Depository, provides, SNAP provides the equivalent of 9 meals. So the need that will be created with some of these reductions is more than we're equipped to handle.
While federal programs like SNAP are the backbone of food assistance, Hoops highlights how some states, schools, and other local nonprofits are stepping up with creative solutions to help families in need.
We're seeing some great action across the country, all different kinds of stakeholders stepping up, good action at state and local governments. May 1st in Hawaii, the state legislature approved expanding free school meal access to cover more children and specifically to help ALICE families.
These kinds of programs can ease the strain for families in the short term. But Hoops feels that the bigger long-term picture is still troubling. The fragility of today's labor market leaves millions of households on shaky ground.
Of all adults in the U.S., only 22% have the security of a full-time salary job. And that means the rest are working hourly paid or part-time or looking for work or are out of the workforce. And I think that helps sum up the precarious nature of our economy right now.
The reality is sobering. But there are resources out there and ways to get involved. So where can households turn for help if they need it? Hoops says this is the best first step.
That's to dial 211 on your phone and connect to the reference and referral service that links you to resources that are in your community. So 211 is across the country, but when you call in from a location, it goes to the resources that are in that location. And it's run by United Ways and state governments across the country. And it's also available online. So you could go to 211.org. And that's probably the fastest way to be connected to things that meet your needs and fit your situation.
Beyond seeking help, there are also ways for listeners to support the fight against food insecurity. Food banks and nonprofits depend on volunteers, donations, and advocacy to keep shelves stocked and programs running. Even small contributions of time or resources can make a difference in your community. Looking ahead, food insecurity isn't just about empty pantries and fridges. It's about the constant trade-offs that individuals and families must make to survive. Local food banks and nonprofits are doing their part, but long-term progress depends on sustained investment and smart policy at every level of our government. To learn more about United for Alice and the Greater Chicago Food Depository, as well as our guests this week, Stephanie Hoops and Cameron Mattson, visit viewpointsradio.org. This segment was written by our executive producer, Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Marty Peterson.
Viewpoints returns in just a moment.
Whoa, it's you, the Capital One Bank guy.
That's what they call me.
Mind if I get a selfie?
Yeah, sure thing. Say no fees or minimums on your Capital One checking account.
Wow, that's a keeper. So, where are you heading?
I'm off to spread the good news that Capital One helps people keep more money in their wallet with no overdraft fees.
Oh, you're the best Capital One Bank guy.
Hey, mind if I get a selfie?
Sure.
Say, Capital One, what's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.
Fabrice.
It's a classic odor tale. You fried fish for dinner, cleaned up, but the smell is still in the house. And the neighbors are coming over for game night. They're on their way. And then you spray Febreze Air Mist. Febreze Air starts working instantly to fight even your toughest odors, so you go from fish to fresh like that. Now all you have to worry about is Pam cheating at charades.
Breathe happy Febreze, la 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 la.
This is Viewpoints Explained. I'm Ebony McMorris. The country's report card recently came back, and it's not good news. High school reading scores have sunk to their lowest point in more than 30 years. Results from the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is considered the nation's most reliable benchmark test, show that about a third of last year's seniors scored below basic reading proficiency. About 35% of students scored just proficient marks in reading. So what's behind the big drop? Experts say more students are regularly missing class since the pandemic, and this has led up to interrupted learning. Last year, a survey led by the National Assessment of Educational Progress showed that almost a quarter of fourth graders missed five or more days of school in the previous month. That's double the rate reported in 2019. On top of all this, more young people are spending several hours in front of screens. This leaves less time to read and makes it harder to sit down and focus for a long stretch of time. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, teens now spend an average of 7.5 hours a day on screens for entertainment, while kids age 8 to 12 log nearly 5 hours daily, not counting schoolwork. On the upside, some states are taking a proactive approach to teaching reading in order to turn things around. Research shows that teaching letters and sounds in precise logical sequences at an early age, like kindergarten and first grade, can help boost spelling, fluency, and understanding. For example, in Mississippi, schools are doing exactly this while also investing in extra teacher training and early intervention help for kids who seem to be struggling. The state, which used to rank near the bottom in reading scores, has now climbed to the top of early reading performance. At the end of the day, falling behind in reading limits a student's academic path and their success after high school. It also closes the door on an entirely different creative experience. Reading is an active way to step into other people's perspectives and lifetimes. It helps us learn new things and stay curious about the world. Without it, these things vanish and we're reliant on the passive role of watching screen after screen. That's Viewpoints Explained for this week. More in a moment.
Welcome to Culture Crash, where we examine what's new and old in entertainment. Fresh off her success with 2024's Short and Sweet, Sabrina Carpenter is right back at it in 2025 with her latest album, Man's Best Friend. Carpenter has taken some heat online and in the press for releasing two albums so close together, with some questioning how much artistic growth is really evident from last year to this year. The argument is that she's simply releasing more of the same to capitalize on a moment of celebrity. But that's not how I see it at all. Where Short and Sweet included four songs with writing and or production credits from Jack Antonoff, Man's Best Friend has nine such tracks. The work that Carpenter and Antonoff started in last year's Please, Please, Please is further built upon with the poppier Manchild, the Dolly Parton reminiscent ballad We Almost Broke Up Again Last Night, and the triumphantly rock-infused Goodbye. It feels like two artists who struck gold last year and wanted to continue working together to further explore their shared musical references and passions. I hear artistic growth all over Man's Best Friend, which serves as a powerful showcase of Carpenter's ability to pull from musical heroes across decades of pop music and tie them all together with her trademark lyrics full of clever turns of phrase and tongue-in-cheek double entendres. The album is a little bit ABBA, a little bit Christina Aguilera, and a little bit Donna Summer, reminiscent of Earth, Wind & Fire and also Ariana Grande. Soaked in Antonoff-led production that brings in elements of his band Bleachers and his musical heroes like Bruce Springsteen and the Beatles. Man's Best Friend is familiar and novel at the same time, and it absolutely demands to be danced to and sung along with. It's a supernova pop album in a year that was desperate for an injection of fun. I'm Evan Rook.
Do Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis symptoms keep coming back? Tremfya, guselkumab, may help, with rapid remission achieved at 12 weeks and lasting clinical remission at 1 year. Some even saw visible improvement of their intestinal lining at 12 weeks and 1 year. Tremfya is a prescription medicine used to treat adults with moderately to severely active Crohn's disease and adults with moderately to severely active ulcerative colitis. Serious allergic reactions and increased risk of infections and liver problems may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection, flu-like symptoms, or if you need a vaccine. Healing is possible with Tremfya. Approximately 3 out of 10 patients were in endoscopic remission at 1 year, based on areas visualized on colonoscopy, which may not represent the deeper bowel layer or entire GI tract. Individual results may vary. Ask your doctor about Tremfya today. Call 1-800-526-7736 to learn more or visit TremfyaRadio.com.
And that's Viewpoints for this week. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming shows and find a library of past programs on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and more information about our guests at viewpointsradio.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Viewpoints.
Here's a dose of reality. Driving under the influence of prescription painkillers is just as illegal and just as deadly as driving drunk. In fact, there are nearly 2,000 drug-related crashes every year in Wisconsin. Help prevent drugged driving and let's achieve zero preventable deaths on Wisconsin roadways. Driving on pills kills. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Departments of Health Services, Transportation, and Justice.
Step into a world where magic and merriment come alive. Discover fantastical creatures, behold thrilling jousts, and meet your favorite characters of old. From rib-tickling jesters to spellbinding performances, the adventure never ends. Make memories that will last through the ages at the most magical village on Earth, the Minnesota Renaissance Festival. Plan your visit today at renaissancefest.com. Huzzah!
It's the Eco Minute, powered by Clean Wisconsin, your environmental voice since 1970. I'm Amy Berrio. A new analysis from Clean Wisconsin shows AI data centers in the state will use more power than all the homes in Wisconsin combined. Potential energy demand has been disclosed for just two projects in the state, the Vantage Data Center in Port Washington and Phase 1 of the Microsoft Data Center in Mount Pleasant. Those two projects alone require a combined 3.9 gigawatts of power, which is enough energy to power more than 4 million Wisconsin homes. Wisconsin has just under 3 million housing units in the entire state. Senator Tammy Baldwin has announced Senate passage of a bill that will help protect Wisconsin lakes from toxic algae. The legislation would improve monitoring, forecasting, and prevention of harmful algal blooms by requiring better coordination among task force agencies, state and local entities, and tribes. Right now on the Defender podcast, the Wisconsin Climate March is coming. Listen to find out more at cleanwisconsin.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get ready to go for the green and gold on this local civic media radio station. Listen each weekday for the keywords to text for your chance to win our daily prize, $200 cash and gold jewelry. And be entered to win our grand prize, two indoor club level seats to see the green and gold take on Minnesota in Green Bay. Just download our free Civic Media app and listen weekdays at 7, 9, 11, 1, 3, 5, and 7 for your chance to win in our multi-state contest. For complete rules, go to civicmedia.us.
D&D Tire and Auto brings you the Go for the Gold Text to Win contest on Trail Mix 103.1 Park Falls. More than oil changes, tires, tune-ups, diagnostics, towing, your Cooper and Goodyear dealer with free lifetime rotations and community pride.
Make every day extraordinary with something special from Wisconsin. From artisan cheeses to fresh produce to maple syrup, the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection's Something Special from Wisconsin program is proud to work with member businesses that certify their Wisconsin-made and processed products. Look for the red and yellow sticker and visit somethingspecialfromwisconsin.com to find member businesses and products made with care, quality, and love. Sponsored by Wisconsin DATCP.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Low clouds and fog giving way to shower and thunderstorm chances. Highs close to the 70-degree mark and a southwest breeze. Tonight, any showers and storms ending, but we'll see more low clouds and fog form. Lows in the lower 50s. It's 57 at our studios.
You're listening to Radio Health Journal, the trusted news source for medicine, science, and technology. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
I'm Mayan Vasta Betancourt.
And I'm Greg Johnson. This week, immigrant doctors are crucial to U.S. healthcare, but they're frequently disrespected.
If they were working with white patients, often the white patient would not respect their authority and would ask them to go find the real doctor.
But first, if we have so many effective tools to fight HIV, why is it still an epidemic?
And I just remember taking that train ride all the way back home and feeling like my life was over. My very young 17-year-old life was already coming to an end.
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Y'all ready for Gillette's best shave? Try Gillette Labs with 5 ultra-thin blades, a built-in exfoliating bar, a precision trimmer on the back for sharp lineups. Gillette Labs delivers that smooth shave. Plus, and check this out, with one refill, you'll get up to 30 shaves. And on average, the blades last 50% longer than Gillette Fusion. Got something special coming up and you gotta look good? Check out Gillette Labs, the best a man can get. Gillette Labs also available in heated.
In 1994, Keith Green was in his last year of high school, excited for whatever surprises the future had in store. Maybe he'd go to college or move to a new city where he could make an impact. Green was already an active member of his community and had been spending the last few months of his high school career helping set up an annual blood drive.
Initially, wasn't planning to donate blood because I was a little scared of passing out. kind of a cool kid. I didn't want people to see that. I didn't want to ruin my reputation. So I wasn't going to donate. However, my girlfriend at the time sort of convinced me that I had to. You have to lead by example, that sort of thing. And so I did. A couple of weeks later, I got a letter from LifeSource, who was the company who done the blood drive for us, pretty much suggesting that I don't donate any more blood and that I make an appointment to come into their offices.
It was a vague letter that left way too much room for Green's imagination to run wild. He knew sickle cell anemia runs in his family. Had they detected it in his blood? After they refused to give Green any more information over the phone, he set up an appointment and hopped on the train after school.
The woman sat me down and she basically just said, "Did you know that you were HIV positive?" And of course, I didn't know. I was in complete shock. I don't remember a whole lot about the rest of that interaction, right? It was very like a blur, still a blur. I don't remember a whole lot of it, but I do remember that she gave me some information, some pamphlets, stuff like that to read and review. And I just remember taking that train ride all the way back home and feeling like my life was over. You know, my very young 17-year-old life was already coming to an end.
Human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, is an infection that weakens the immune system until patients are unable to fight off any illness. There's no cure. And though we now have various treatments to help patients keep their infection under control, that wasn't the case in 1994.
Average lifespan for people living with HIV at that time was 8 to 10 years. We didn't have all of the medications that we have now. The Lazarus effect, if you will, wasn't a thing at that time. Protease inhibitors didn't exist. So I had no real reason to believe that I'd live longer than 8 to 10 years.
Though there weren't many options, Green was able to go on 3 different drugs that he was prescribed to take a couple times a day.
And I remember that one of them was this sort of big white quarter-sized chalky pill that you had to take on an empty stomach, and it tasted horrible. It was just absolutely disgusting. And I also remember just feeling lethargic, nauseous, you know, not well. And I started taking medications around the same time that I started my first semester of college. I actually started at Columbia College. And it was just so dreadful that I just stopped.
It was a decision between Green's mental health or his medication, a choice that stretched for 8 years before his doctor made sure Green knew it was becoming a choice between life and death.
When they drew my labs, I had a T-cell count of 30, and my viral load was well into the hundreds of thousands. And so I was told at that time that, you know, if I didn't get on medications, it was likely I wouldn't survive. I had some friends who lived here and then moved to Charlotte, North Carolina. I moved to Charlotte really because I didn't want my family to witness what I was going through. I started to lose a great deal of weight, was really sick for a period of time. So I literally went there to die.
Though he desperately needed medical care, Green says accessing it was nearly impossible without insurance.
To access the public health system there, there was a phone number that you had to call between 8 and 9 in the morning. That's the only time you could call to get an appointment. And generally, those appointments were, the available appointments for that day were gone before you got to 9 o'clock. So I had to go through several days of making an appointment. And I remember when I finally was able to get an appointment, we were a couple of months out. So it was just a nightmare trying to access healthcare in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Thankfully, a friend was able to help Green out, and he found a specialist who immediately put Green back on a treatment plan. But by this time, he had let the disease progress so far, there was still a chance he wouldn't make it.
I was hospitalized for several weeks. You know, I'm 6'4". Average weight was, at that time, about 190, 195 pounds. I withered away to about 144 pounds and was literally, at one point, given 6 months to a year to live.
Against all odds, Green's numbers began to turn around. Instead of a sure death sentence, he once again began imagining a possible future. The doctor handed him a copy of a magazine called Positively Aware's 2002 HIV Drug Guide, and Green began to map out his next steps.
And I kind of made a pact with myself in that moment that if I got back to Chicago, I would seek out this place because obviously there have been all of these advances in medications that I didn't know a whole lot about. And people were living, and I needed to, they had information that I needed to get, so I needed to get there.
Green did eventually end up back in Chicago and worked his way up the ranks at the magazine, becoming an associate editor. He went on to become a co-founder of the Chicago Black Gay Men's Caucus, of which he is now the executive director. The organization aims to end HIV by increasing health equity and developing innovative programs. And though HIV.gov reports that cases dropped 12% between 2018 and 2022, there's still a lot of obstacles that prevention programs face. Green says a main issue is stigma. It keeps people from ever having these important conversations with their doctors.
There's still many medical professionals who don't believe in PrEP and stigmatize or shame folks for asking for it or using it. I think that there's a great deal of what we call slut shaming, where, you know, if folks are on PrEP, they're assumed to be promiscuous. And so then that also leads to the, like, I'm not promiscuous, I don't need that, right? But any encounter could potentially put you at risk. And so it doesn't matter whether you're promiscuous or not. If you are sexually active, PrEP is something that is for you.
One of the things we know is that stigma is a big driver of why we haven't gotten to where we need to be. There's a lot of stigma, and until we end stigma, we can't end HIV.
That's Dr. Toyin Nwafor, Executive Director of U.S. HIV Medical Affairs at Gilead Sciences. She says that stigma can drastically reduce the number of people getting tested and their willingness to continue care.
If they're going into spaces where they don't feel affirmed, they feel judged, they feel like somebody sees me going to that clinic, right? So then people stop taking their meds. Stigma impacts somebody's mental health and ability to stay on therapy. If you just keep feeling like every time you take that pill, it reminds you of just how you felt the first time you got that diagnosis. So stigma is such a big part. So initiatives that normalize conversation, that normalize that we're all HIV possible, that if you're sexually active, there are ways to prevent HIV, and that nobody cares about how you're having sex and who you're having sex with. That's your personal life, and that's your personal choice, and that routinizing that conversation is what needs to happen.
If you've never gotten tested for HIV, you're part of the majority in America. Despite the CDC issuing guidelines in 2006 that everyone over age 13 should be tested at least once, only about 36% of adults have. Nwafor says part of the hesitancy has to do with how HIV testing began.
Initially, right, with the first few cases of people living with HIV diagnosed, it was thought to be only in certain risk groups, right? Men who have sex with men or injection drug use. So some of those initial testing and how healthcare providers taught was very located in certain populations. That has changed clearly over the last 3.5 decades. But it's taking people a long time to catch on, not just community, but also healthcare providers.
Nwafor says that the test has become more mainstream in certain cases. It's become a routine part of prenatal testing panels for pregnant women and for anyone wanting to take HIV preventative medication.
But there's still a big discrepancy between recommendations and what's actually happening. And there are many times when people who have been engaging in healthcare assume they've actually had an HIV test. When they go in and say, test me for everything, they assume that their healthcare provider did it already. So there's still a lot of work to be done about why it's not happening. And some of it has to do with healthcare provider bias, comfort or discomfort in having the conversation where they're practicing. And that's why the CDC took out risk-based testing and just said if people are sexually active, they should have an HIV test. And that's what's going to happen. That's the only way we're going to kind of move forward with getting it done.
Which is why Nwafor believes that many of the HIV prevention initiatives that focus on community outreach must also include the broader scope of healthcare professionals. For her and Green, the most effective message will educate the patients, doctors, and pharmaceutical companies.
You have these innovative technologies that literally could prevent someone from contracting HIV that just in 2025 still remain out of reach.
With Gilead Sciences, there's been a commitment for, 35 years now, right, to innovation in medication discovery, right? Not just in HIV, but also in viral hepatitis, right? A lot of curative therapy for hepatitis, in oncology, right? In oncology, in liver disease. But what's clear is that medications and products don't end epidemics, programs do, right? Because a medicine is only as good as getting to the right person at the right time, when they need it, how they need to use it.
Nuafor believes that public-private partnerships between HIV advocacy groups and healthcare companies are the bridge between innovation and real-life impact.
The healthcare system and partnerships within the patient community and pharma and academia and public health needs to come into play so that we can actually take interventions and actually make them tangible and real for people who need them the most.
You can find more information about Dr. Toyin Nuafor, Keith Green, and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Radio Health Journal on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
Coming up, how will current immigration policies impact America's healthcare workforce? When Radio Health Journal returns.
I'm still going for it, even with higher stroke risk from atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem. Over a 3-year study, Eliquis apixaban tablets reduced stroke risk better than warfarin, and over 97% of Eliquis patients did not experience a stroke. A first stroke occurred in 2.9% of warfarin patients versus 2.3% of Eliquis patients.
Don't stop prescription Eliquis without asking your doctor. Stroke risk may increase. Eliquis can cause serious and potentially fatal bleeding. Don't take if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or bleed longer. A spinal injection increases blood clot risk, which may cause paralysis. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding or bruising, or back pain, tingling, numbness, muscle weakness, or incontinence. Aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners increase bleeding risk. Tell your doctor about planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
Immigrant doctors play a crucial role in the U.S. healthcare system, serving patients in parts of the country where there's a shortage of doctors. These highly qualified medical professionals from Southeast Asia and elsewhere have the same amount of training as American doctors, if not more. They take the same exams as U.S.-trained professionals in order to receive their accreditation or licensing to practice in the U.S. And yet, many still are victims of racism and other prejudices from their patients who question their skill and expertise.
If they were working with white patients, often the white patient would not respect their authority and would ask them to go find the real doctor. There was another example of a physician who was working with Black patients, and the Black patients were judging his level of medical knowledge and saying, oh, you're from this land of snake charmers, and do you actually know what you're doing? And so I think that these physicians often, from all sides, would experience these questions around their competence and their ability to do the work, which is, competence is coded for, it's a very racist kind of idea here.
That's Iram Alam, associate professor of history of science at Harvard University and author of The Care of Foreigners, How Immigrant Physicians Changed U.S. Healthcare. The number of immigrant doctors in the U.S. is 1 in 4. However, the ratio can be much higher in areas of the country where there are physician shortages. In rural hospitals, for example, it's possible for 100% of physicians to be immigrants. But regardless of the biases they face, these professionals work around it to give their patients the best care possible.
Some of that meant just kind of absorbing it. Other times it meant figuring out different strategies for how they would speak to people or address the patients. And often what it meant was just that over time, there was a recognition that this was the only physician that was available to people. And so there was almost a, what are you going to do? It's either this or nothing.
Although some patients may choose to do nothing, Alam says more often than not, most choose to see the foreign specialist.
It's a really complicated dynamic, especially because Having an encounter with a physician is such an intimate encounter. It's such a vulnerable kind of encounter. So in some ways, I think that I'm not sure if it makes it worse or if it makes it less bad in that way. Like, you're coming from a place of actually really requiring this care and being vulnerable to it as well. So I think it takes time. I think it's taken persistence on the part of immigrant physicians and their presence and having to prove themselves and having to prove their competence often. But, you know, on their part, it feels like the conditions of their legal entry in the United States. And also, I think, a commitment to the profession and a commitment to providing care.
The U.S. government has a long history of recruiting foreign doctors to staff what are called health professional shortage areas, or HPSAs. The practice started at the end of World War II and has continued ever since.
Health profession shortage areas are these designations that the federal government makes where there are fewer than one physician for 3,500 people who live in those areas. And these designations can be all over. So they can be in rural communities, they can be in urban centers, but it just means that there's an inadequate number of physicians to the populations. So these often are areas that are impoverished, under-resourced, and they're not attractive places that U.S.-trained physicians would like to go and work because the conditions they're difficult to work in.
Immigrant doctors who are here on a J-1 visa have to return to their home country for at least 2 years after completing their training. To bypass this requirement, they can choose to work full-time in an HPSA, medically underserved area, or medically underserved population for at least 3 years. However, Allen believes that this practice of recruiting foreign doctors is simply putting a bandage on a bigger problem. She believes medical students should be cultivated from rural or underserved areas in the hopes that they'll return to serve their home communities. Otherwise, there's no incentive for doctors to want to practice there. Allen says another factor in these shortage areas is the cost of medical school.
One of the reasons why I chose not to go to medical school and to go to PhD school was I didn't come from a wealthy family. And the idea of taking on that much debt was too overwhelming. And so what happens then is you end up getting these shortages. Also, it's shortage of specialties. So things like internal medicine, family medicine, pediatrics, the specialties that are not as lucrative are the ones that immigrant physicians are often trained in or, you know, are sent to go and receive training in, because U.S. trained physicians, they want to work in specialties where they can get paid more so they can also pay off their debt faster and not be in these excruciating kinds of, you know, cycles of educational debt.
Allen believes the healthcare systems in Canada and the United Kingdom provide a more judicial model that tends to limit doctor shortages to some degree.
Physicians are salaried government employees, part of the national healthcare system. And so the ways that they are asked to move and work, and that work is organized. And of course, they still have shortages and are dealing with similar kinds of issues. But the distribution of how people are organized is different than it is in the United States, where it's really based on a much more, I mean, it's a free market logic. And the ways that people are compensated is based on their geographic proximity to other practitioners. That's how insurance allocates reimbursements. This is not going to incentivize people to go and work in rural areas, you know, or under-resourced hospitals in urban areas at all. For U.S. trained physicians, for immigrant physicians, that's what's available to them. And so they end up going there.
And though these physicians are working where no one else is willing to, they still face blatant prejudice. Thankfully, Allen says celebrity doctors such as Abraham Verghese have helped to dispel some of the implicit biases some American patients have toward immigrant doctors. However, it's possible that these physicians won't be able to continue this custom. The current immigration policies have created pretty big obstacles for international medical graduates. Visa delays could drastically impact America's workforce and, in turn, worsen many Americans' access to healthcare.
These physicians and immigrant nurses and other kinds of care workers in long-term care facilities are so vitally important to the functioning of the U.S. healthcare system. And the kinds of erratic and xenophobic immigration policies that are being enacted right now are going to have a very adverse effect on the health of the U.S. population.
Alum's book, The Care of Foreigners, How Immigrant Physicians Changed U.S. Healthcare, is available now for pre-order. You can find more information about Iram Alum and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Radio Health Journal on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Our writer-producer this week is Polly Hansen. Our lead producer is Kristen Farah. Our production manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Greg Johnson.
Radio Health Journal returns in just a moment.
Oh, could this vintage store be any cuter?
Right? And the best part? They accept Discover.
Accept Discover? In a little place like this? I don't think so, Jennifer.
Oh, yeah, huh? Discover's accepted where I like to shop. Come on, baby, get with the times.
Right, so we shouldn't get the parachute pants?
These are making a comeback, I think.
Discover is accepted at 99% of places that take credit cards nationwide. Based on the February 2025 Nielsen report.
At Charmin, we heard you shouldn't talk about going to the bathroom in public, so we decided to sing about it.
Light a candle, pour some wine. Grab a roll, the soft kind for a little me time. Charmin Ultra Soft Smooth Tear. Wavy edges for my rear. So let the softness caress your soul. Just relax, you're on a roll. Let her rip. Charmin Ultra Soft Smooth Tear.
Charmin Ultra Soft Smooth Tear has the same softness you love. Now with wavy edges that tear better than the leading one-ply brand. Enjoy the go with Charmin.
Progressive knows if you have to choose between everyday life and your RV, RV wins.
What, are you going to take the RV to the mountains or go pick up your dry cleaning?
RV wins!
Are we cleaning the gutters or taking the RV camping?
RV wins!
Are we getting a new passport or cruising up the coast?
RV wins!
Don't forget, you got that trip to Sweden coming up.
Oh, yeah, passport, then RV.
With Progressive, you can bundle your RV with your home or auto and save with a discount and spend more time enjoying those savings in your RV. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates and other insurers not available in all states and situations.
Oh, how's that flu, babe? Did you take DayQuil Intense Flu yet?
Nah, I got this. Ugh, okay, I don't got this.
You stay on the couch and I'll grab the DayQuil.
Undo your flu symptoms with DayQuil Intense Flu. DayQuil Intense Flu provides powerful relief of your flu symptoms.
I'm ready for that to-do list.
Wow, you do got this.
DayQuil Intense Flu, the daytime coughing, aching, fever, under your flu medicine. Use as directed, keep out of reach of children.
Medical notes this week. Are you taking too many medications? In a review of nearly 2,000 older adults, about 1 in 3 took 5 or more prescription drugs. These people had worse balance, weaker grip strength, and walked slower than their peers. Researchers believe it's not necessarily the type of drugs that are contributing to this difference, but simply the sheer number of them. The research, published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, supports the need for physicians to consider a patient's functional health when prescribing. Your blood may soon have tiny robots flowing through it. Drugs administered through IVs aren't often as precise as they need to be, so researchers have found a solution: robots. These microdevices are injected and then moved to a specific target area using magnets. The scientists hope this will help patients get the most out of their medications. The study is published in the journal Science Advances. We can detect more cases of Alzheimer's disease, so why aren't we? New research shows that a majority of older Americans understand why early detection is important, but only 1 in 5 have had a recent cognitive screening. The numbers are even lower for Hispanic and Asian Americans. These early screenings are important to help slow the disease as early as possible. The research is published in Alzheimer's and Dementia, Diagnosis, Assessment, and Disease Monitoring. And finally, a new fix for carbon monoxide poisoning. Just over 1,000 Americans die from CO poisoning each year. Thankfully, a new protein-based therapy helps the body rapidly get rid of the carbon monoxide through urine. The research is published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. And that's Medical Notes this week. I'm Mayan Vasta Betancourt.
Do Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis symptoms keep coming back? Tremfya, guselkumab, may help, with rapid remission achieved at 12 weeks and lasting clinical remission at 1 year. Some even saw visible improvement of their intestinal lining at 12 weeks and 1 year. Tremfya is a prescription medicine used to treat adults with moderately to severely active Crohn's disease and adults with moderately to severely active ulcerative colitis. Serious allergic reactions and increased risk of infections and liver problems may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection, flu-like symptoms, or if you need a vaccine. Healing is possible with Tremfya. Approximately 3 out of 10 patients were in endoscopic remission at 1 year, based on areas visualized on colonoscopy, which may not represent the deeper bowel layer or entire GI tract. Individual results may vary. Ask your doctor about Tremfya today. Call 1-800-526-7736 to learn more or visit TremfyaRadio.com. Thank you for joining us this week and every week as we break down the science stories you need to know. You can find all of our past segments and guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and X for daily content, and tune in next week for another edition of Radio Health Journal.
You're listening to 103.1 FM and 980 AM WPFP Park Falls. This is Trail Mix 103.1.
Well, I guess it would be nice if I could touch your body. I know not everybody has got a body like you. But I gotta think twice before I give my heart away. And I know all the games you play. I gotta have faith.